The sudden explosion of Taggart's voice sounded as if he had been slapped.
"Who are you to stand against the government? Who are you, you miserable little office rat, to judge national policies and hold opinions of your own? Do you think the country has time to bother about your opinions, your wishes, or your precious little conscience? You're going to learn a lesson, all of you. All of you spoiled, self-indulgent, undisciplined little two-bit clerks who strut as if that crap about your rights was serious. You're going to learn that these are not the days of Nat Taggart."
Eddie said nothing. For an instant, they stood looking at each other across the desk. Taggart's face was distorted by terror. Eddie's remained sternly serene. James Taggart believed the existence of an Eddie Willers too well. Eddie Willers could not believe the existence of a James Taggart.
"Do you think the nation will bother about your wishes or hers?" screamed Taggart. "It's her duty to come back. It's her duty to work. What do we care whether she wants to work or not? We need her."
"Do you, Jim?" An impulse pertaining to self-preservation made Taggart back a step away from the sound of that particular tone, a very quiet tone, in the voice of Eddie Willers. But Eddie made no move to follow. He remained standing behind his desk in a manner suggesting the civilized tradition of a business office. "You won't find her," he said. "She won't be back. I'm glad she won't. You can starve, you can close the railroad, you can throw me in jail, you can have me shot. What does it matter? I won't tell you where she is. If I see the whole country crashing, I won't tell you. You won't find her. You..." They whirled at the sound of the entrance door flung open. They saw Dagny standing on the threshold. She wore a wrinkled cotton dress, and her hair was disheveled by hours of driving. She stopped for the duration of a glance around her, as if to recapture the place, but there was no recognition of persons in her eyes. The glance merely swept through the room, as if making a swift inventory of physical objects. Her face was not the face they remembered. It had aged, not by means of lines, but by means of a still, naked look, stripped of any quality save ruthlessness. Yet their first response, ahead of shock or wonder, was a single emotion that went through the room like a gasp of relief. It was in all their faces, but one. Eddie Willers, who alone had been calm a moment ago, collapsed with his face down on his desk. He made no sound, but the movements of his shoulders were sobs. Her face gave no sign of acknowledgement to anyone, no greeting, as if her presence here were inevitable and no words were necessary. She went straight to the door of her office, passing the desk of her secretary. She said, her voice like the sound of a business machine, neither rude nor gentle, "Ask Eddie to come in." James Taggart was the first one to move, as if dreading to let her out of his sight. He rushed in after her. He cried, "I couldn't help it!" And then, life returning to him, his own, his normal kind of life, he screamed, "It was your fault. You did it. You're to blame for it, because you left." He wondered whether his scream had been an illusion inside his own ears. Her face remained blank, yet she had turned to him. She looked as if sounds had reached her. But not words, not the communication of a mind. What he felt for a moment was his closest approach to a sense of his own non-existence. Then he saw the faintest change in her face, merely the indication of perceiving a human presence. But she was looking past him, and he turned and saw that Eddie Willers had entered the office. There were traces of tears in Eddie's eyes, but he made no attempt to hide them. He stood straight, as if the tears, or any embarrassment, or any apology for them, were as irrelevant to him as to her. She said, "Get Ryan on the telephone. Tell him I'm here, then let me speak to him." Ryan had been the general manager of the Railroad Central region. Eddie gave her a warning by not answering at once, then said, his voice as even as hers, "Ryan's gone, Dagny. He quit last week." They did not notice Taggart, as they did not notice the furniture around them. She had not granted him even the recognition of ordering him out of her office. Like a paralytic, uncertain of his muscles' obedience, he gathered his strength and slipped out. But he was certain of the first thing he had to do. He hurried to his office to destroy his letter of resignation. She did not notice his exit. She was looking at Eddie. "Is Noland here?" she asked. "No, he's gone." "Andrews?" "Gone." "McGuire?" "Gone." He went on quietly to recite the list of those he knew she would ask for, those most needed in this hour who had resigned and vanished within the past month. She listened without astonishment or emotion, as one listens to the casualty list of a battle where all are doomed, and it makes no difference whose names fall first. When he finished, she made no comment, but asked, "What has been done since this morning?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?" "Dagny, any office boy could have issued orders here since this morning, and everybody would have obeyed him. But even the office boys know that whoever makes the first move today will be held responsible for the future, the present, and the past. When the buck passing begins, he would not save the system. He would merely lose his job by the time he saved one division. Nothing has been done. It stopped still. Whatever is moving on anyone's blind guess, out on the line where they don't know whether they're to move or to stop. Some trains are held at stations, others are going on, waiting to be stopped before they reach Colorado. It's whatever the local dispatchers decide. The terminal manager downstairs has canceled all transcontinental traffic for today, including tonight's Comet. I don't know what the manager in San Francisco is doing. Only the wrecking crews are working at the tunnel. They haven't come anywhere near the wreck as yet. I don't think they will. Phone the terminal manager downstairs and tell him to put all transcontinental trains back on the schedule at once, including tonight's Comet, then come back here. When he came back, she was bending over the maps she had spread on a table, and she spoke while he made rapid notes. Route all westbound trains south from Kirby, Nebraska, down the spur track to Hastings, down the track of the Kansas Western to Laurel, Kansas, then to the track of the Atlantic Southern at Jasper, Oklahoma. West on the Atlantic Southern to Flagstaff, Arizona, north on the track of the Flagstaff-Homedale to Elgin, Utah, north to Midland, northwest on the track of the Wasatch Railway to Salt Lake City. The Wasatch Railway is an abandoned narrow gauge. Buy it. Have the gauge spread to standard. If the owners are afraid, since sales are illegal, pay them twice the money and proceed with the work. There is no rail between Laurel, Kansas, and Jasper, Oklahoma. 3 miles. No rail between Elgin and Midland, Utah. 5.5 miles. Have the rail laid. Have construction crews start at once. Recruit every local man available. Pay twice the legal wages. 3 times, anything they ask. Put 3 shifts on and have the job done overnight. For rail, tear up the sidings at Winston, Colorado, at Silver Springs, Colorado, at Leeds, Utah, at Benson, Nevada. If any local stooges of the Unification Board come to stop the work, give authority to our local men, the ones you trust, to bribe them. Don't put that through the accounting department. Charge it to me. I'll pay it. If they find some case where it doesn't work, have them tell the stooge that Directive 10-289 does not provide for local injunctions, that an injunction has to be brought against our headquarters, and that they have to sue me if they wish to stop us.
Is that true?
How do I know? How can anybody know? But by the time they untangle it and decide whatever it is they please to decide, our track will be built.
I see.
I'll go over the lists and give you the names of our local men to put in charge, if they're still there. By the time tonight's Comet reaches Kirby, Nebraska, the track will be ready. It will add about 36 hours to the transcontinental schedule. But there will be a transcontinental schedule. Then have them get for me, out of the files, the old maps of our road as it was before Nat Taggart's grandson built the tunnel.
The what?
He did not raise his voice, but the catch of his breath was the break of emotion he had wanted to avoid. Her face did not change, but a faint note in her voice acknowledged him, a note of gentleness, not reproof. The old maps of the days before the tunnel. We're going back, Eddie. Let's hope we can. No, we won't rebuild the tunnel. There's no way to do it now. But the old grade that crossed the Rockies is still there. It can be reclaimed. Only it will be hard to get the rail for it, and the men to do it, particularly the men. He knew, as he had known from the first, that she had seen his tears, and that she had not walked past in indifference, even though her clear, toneless voice and unmoving face gave him no sign of feeling. There was some quality in her manner, which he sensed but could not translate. Yet the feeling it gave him, translated, was as if she were saying to him, "I know, I understand. I would feel compassion and gratitude if we were alive and free to feel. But we're not, are we, Eddie? We're on a dead planet like the moon where we must move, not dare to stop for a breath of feeling, or we'll discover that there is no air to breathe." "We have today and tomorrow to get things started," she said. "I'll leave for Colorado tomorrow night. If you want to fly, I'll have to rent a plane for you somewhere. Yours is still in the shops. They can't get the parts for it."
"No, I'll go by rail. I have to see the line. I'll take tomorrow's Comet."
It was 2 hours later, in a brief pause between long-distance phone calls, that she asked him suddenly the first question which did not pertain to the railroad.
What have they done to Hank Reardon?